Following is a tape recording taken from the church history class of Professor Philip Schrader. Today's lesson includes a lecture by Dr. Carl S. Meyer on Puritanism and the Covenant Theology.
On Tuesday, I went over to the dentist to have an infected tooth pulled out of my jaw, and so that removed the impurities there. I ought to be in shape to jaw about the Puritans. I thought I'd put my worst cheek forward. To cover a movement going over more than 100 years and spanning two continents, and to try to do that in the time allotted is going to push us. I think that we ought to define our term Puritanism, first of all, in its historic context, simply as a historical movement extending from about the year 1550 to about the year 1680, found in both England and in America. As an historical movement, it has its political, social, economic, and ecclesiastical consequences for both England and America. Can you hear me back there all right? Right. The average Lutheran minister in America, I believe, must be aware of these particular consequences of Puritanism. He should, of course, understand the social order in which the Lord has called him to work. And the social order in America particularly is conditioned more perhaps than we realize by the Reformed churches, and these Reformed churches are by and large the product of Puritanism. We might say that in the religious scene of America, there are, to enumerate, three or possibly four streams. We have the Roman Catholic stream, which is strong, especially after the new immigration about 1890. We have the Lutheran stream, which, as far as American history is concerned, is not of the greatest consequence, although it is emerging as one of the strong streams in American ecclesiastical history. Then we have the Methodist or Arminian stream of Protestantism, and we have the stream of Puritanism with its extreme left fringe going off into liberalism and into the sects. And of these four streams, at least until we come to approximately the year 1900, of these four streams, Puritanism, I believe, is by far the strongest. To understand even some of the movements in European history, Pietism and the evangelical movement particularly, or to understand what has been called in England the nonconformist conscience, or to understand the social gospel and even the movement for modern missions, I believe we can include the ecumenical movement in that list. And we can find that all of these movements have at least some of their roots in Puritanism. Puritanism, therefore, as Perry Miller says, for better or for worse, is one of the continuous factors in American life and thought. Without some understanding of Puritanism, and that at its source, there is no understanding of America. In the Puritan movement, I'll say this, we want to postulate the guidance of the Lord of his church. His direction, I believe, can be seen at times even in the Puritan movement. Oftentimes, of course, it is hidden. And we must recognize that also among the Puritans, there were those who were about their father's business. There were those who used their time and their abilities as his saints. and in their concern for doctrine. Not all of it was at all times false by any means. You might find elements, desirable or undesirable, which will serve you perhaps in a way for your guidance, even professionally. You can find, for instance, among the Puritans those who, in their concern for their calling, and I shall discuss this in a bit more detail later on, I believe give us an example of what it means really to be or to regard oneself as one of God's elect. In the history of Puritanism, I think we ought to highlight, so that we know where we are and when we are, first of all, our geography and our chronology very briefly. Our geography is going to be concerned with England, and that particularly with the southeast, the southeastern part of England, around London and in the territories about the capital of England. We'll have to make some reference to Scotland, but not very much. In this country, we're going to confine ourselves almost entirely to the New England scene. And even in the New England of the 16th and 17th century, while we make some reference to Connecticut, to the Connecticut River Valley especially, it will be mainly the territory around Boston, the Massachusetts Bay territory. Chronologically, the 16th and 17th century, I think that we ought to fix for ourselves, for instance, the dates 1534. 1534, the Act of Supremacy, when you have at least the legal act by which England is separated from the Church of Rome. There is a return to the Church of Rome during the reign of Queen Mary. And then we come again to the year 1559, and the year 1559, the year of the Elizabethan settlement, is of tremendous importance for our story. The year 1588 is a date, of course, that is one of the very most significant dates in world history, the defeat of the Spanish Armada. You know the date 1611, the date of the King James Version. Let's put that down because we can orientate some events around that particular happening. The date 1620, when the pilgrims came to this country, is another date that you remember. 20 years later, the date 1640, the dates of the short parliament, the long parliament, and the outbreak of the Civil War, is one that's easy. If we remember again another 20 years later, the year 1660, the year of the Restoration, you've got that sequence, 1620, 1640, 1660. That's an easy configuration to remember. And then finally, the date 1689, the date of the Toleration Act in England. I'm giving you these dates in this form because I want to refer to some of these events without stopping too long to explain and to modify or to justify my reference to them. In the rise of Puritanism, I think we ought to be aware, let's begin with the economic factors without going into any detail. We ought to be aware of the fact that Puritanism is by and large a middle class movement. And your middle class means that you have there your merchants who are mostly concerned about this particular phase of the Protestant movement of the 16th century. These merchants are in contact with the continent, particularly with the Netherlands. And in the Netherlands, as you know, at least after 1540, you have the spread of Calvinism. The political factors that govern the rise of Puritanism are, of course, nationalism, and then the monarchy in England, The Puritan story is in part the story of the struggle between the monarchy and your middle class or your parliamentary class. Let's recognize the existence of the political factors there. And don't forget that we are in the century of the Renaissance. Shakespeare died in 1616, 5 years after the publication of the King James Version of the Bible, in the period when Puritanism was rising to its height. There are those who want to date Puritanism or want to find in Puritanism an outgrowth of medieval piety. That in the church of the Middle Ages, you have, of course, a strong trend toward piety, and the outgrowth of this piety in England, perhaps modified somewhat by Protestantism, but certainly the roots of this movement, these interpreters claim, are to be found in medieval piety. Strangely enough, there are others that want to find the Puritan movement as an outgrowth of medieval nonconformity, particularly going back to Wycliffe and to the Lollards, and say there in Wycliffe and in the Lollards, you have the beginnings of Puritanism. You can take the Lollard conclusions of 1394 and compare them with the Puritan doctrines. And you will find a great deal of similarity. Objections to many of the rites and practices of the Roman Church, a reference to the papacy as the Antichrist in the Lollard conclusions. And these, of course, become part and parcel of the Puritan outlook. I think, however, that we do well to say that whatever parallels there may have been in earlier centuries, that Puritanism can be that the origins of Puritanism can best be found in the first half of the 16th century. There you have, for one thing, your opposition to Rome. Without going into any detail in this lecture on that particular aspect of Puritan doctrine and Puritan point of view, I should like to at this time emphasize very briefly that one might say an undying opposition to the Church of Rome is one of the strong characteristics of Puritanism. Now that opposition comes out of various factors in the first part of the 16th century. One of those factors is Lutheranism. And at least in that respect, Lutheranism contributed something to the rise of Puritanism. Knappen, K-N-A-P-P-E-N, who is, I believe, the outstanding authority on Tudor Puritanism, claims that William Tyndale, the translator of the Bible, at least the New Testament into English, was a Puritan. Now, in spite of the fact that Knappen was my advisor once upon a time and I had courses under him, I don't quite agree that he has made out a pat case that Tyndale is the father of English Puritanism. But among the associates of Tyndale, I am ready to admit, you will find those who later on became very intimately connected with the Puritan party. And possibly Tyndale would have been a full-blown Puritan had he survived the machinations of Henry VIII. At any rate, Miles Coverdale, who was associated with Tyndale, or at least completed Tyndale's work on the translation of the Bible, In the 1560s, is an outspoken Puritan. In the reign of Henry VIII, and then particularly of his immediate successor, Edward VI, We have the Calvinists who come to the continent and who influence English Protestantism decidedly in the direction of Calvinism. You have there also the presence of John Knox, K-N-O-X, the Scottish reformer. And John Knox is a Calvinist, and in many respects we can simply equate English Calvinism with Puritanism. I don't think entirely, but the marrow, to use one of their phrases, the marrow of Puritan divinity is found in Calvinism. During the early 16th century, or during the first half of the 16th century, we also have Bishop John Hooper, H-O-O-P-E-R. Hooper, when he was nominated as bishop in the reign of Edward VI, refused at first to be consecrated, wearing what he called the papish rags, the vestments of the Church of England, which of course were the heritage of the were from the Roman heritage. He finally wrote to Calvin, and Calvin told him it didn't make too much difference really what he wore when he was consecrated, so he should just go ahead and be consecrated even though he wore these vestments. But there you have one indication of early Puritan thinking, even before the reign of Elizabeth. Well, after the reign of Elizabeth, after the reign of Edward VI, as you know, Bloody Mary comes in, and you have the persecutions of the Protestants, and you have about 800, at least 800, who flee to the continent. And in these Marian exiles, as they are called, these exiles from England to the continent, people who went to Frankfurt and Zurich and Geneva, you have the real beginnings of the Puritans. Now, they came in contact with Calvinism, closer contact with Calvinism on the continent. And there, they fully absorbed Calvinistic theology and were ready to develop their particular emphases of Calvinism. It is then primarily in the Marian exiles at Frankfurt that I believe you can find the first nucleus, the first gathering of the Puritans. After the death of Queen Mary in 1558, Elizabeth becomes queen. And in 1559, and 1559 is the date that you want to note, you have your Elizabethan settlement, a compromise settlement. Elizabeth retained the ceremonies and rites that Henry VIII had retained from the Roman Church. One or two things were modified. But Elizabeth wanted to use her church as an instrument of nationality, and the Puritans wanted to see it used as an instrument for religion. And so they complained that the church was not purified of the vestiges of the Roman religion. This shows itself in the debate already in Parliament in the year 1559 with the adoption of the Elizabethan Book of Common Prayer. Again, in 1563, efforts were made to modify many of the practices of the Church of England. On one occasion, a vote was taken, and the vote of the clergy was one vote in favor of retaining the papish practices, as the Puritans called them. So strong was the Puritan faction by the Puritan clergy. In 1563 already. And in 1563, you have coming to the fore the first of the serious manifestations of Puritanism in England, the so-called Vestiarian controversy. The Vestiarian controversy. It's a controversy about the position, well, first of all, about vestments, of course, about the use of the ring in the marriage ceremony, about making the sign of the cross in the sacrament of baptism, about the use of the table for altar, and so on. Well, this controversy was settled in 1566 simply by the decrees of the archbishop, who announced by his advertisements what should be done and what should not be done, and particularly what vestments should be worn, when to wear the cope and when to wear the surplice, and so on and so forth. And so this first phase of the Puritan movement passed over. Soon after that, the movement developed, however, into the so-called admonition controversy. The admonition controversy that broke out in the year 1572. By that time, the Puritans had decided that they could not get anything by tarrying for the, without tarrying for the magistrate. They decided that it was necessary to petition Parliament. And so in 1572, you have the first admonition. 1572, the first admonition to Parliament, in which Parliament is admonished by these Puritans. Touching the ministry of the word, I have the admonition here. Touching first the ministry of the word, and there they're advocating for the abolition of the bishopric. Secondly, concerning the ministry of the sacraments, and they want some of the abuses as they regard them in the sacraments removed. And thirdly, regarding ecclesiastical discipline, and the question of Puritan discipline we'll come to later on. Then the controversy settles down into a series of pamphlets, which soon become books, a controversy between Cartwright, C-A-R-T-W-R-I-G-H-T, and Whitgift, W-H-I-T-G-I-F-T. But Whitgift was in the official position. And again, no change came about as a result of this admonition controversy. But you notice how this controversy grows. First, it's a question of vestments. Then it's a question of church polity. And then in church polity, you come involved in questions of church doctrine. It may even perhaps be, I can't prove it positively, it may even be that perhaps somewhere back at the very beginnings you can find that the question of personalities entered in first of all, and then it developed into a question of vestments, and then into a question of church polity, and then into a question of doctrine. That's the way many controversies over the years have grown. Well, now, this question of church polity tells us that we cannot, however, simply speak of Puritans in general. We have to distinguish between Presbyterian Puritans and Congregational Puritans. Let me emphasize that these Puritans are inside the Church of England. They haven't stepped out of the Church of England yet. But the Presbyterian Puritans, they want the Presbyterian Church of form government, and the Congregationalists, they, of course, want the congregation absolutely supreme. Then in addition to these two, you have your separatists, and you have your independents, and sometimes between the separatists and the independents, it's rather difficult to tell the difference, but at least sometimes this difference is made. The Puritans within the established church, whether they were Congregationalists or Presbyterians, learned in time or believed in time that they should wait until the death of Elizabeth, and after Elizabeth died, well, then things would get better. But there were people like Robert Browne, B-R-O-W-N-E, who believed that the church should be reformed without tarrying for any, reformation without tarrying for any. Or you have the establishers of Congregationalists, like Greenwood and Barrow, B-A-R-R-O-W-E. His first name is not Wheel, it's Henry. they were responsible for, really, for the rise of Congregationalism. And then within the Church of England, there were those Puritans who called themselves, or who regarded themselves as mystics. And I think we have to recognize that even among the mystics, you find those who have a Puritan label. Now, I'm going to have to pass over the Mar Prelate controversy and John Penry and others, but coming down to the reign of James I, James, coming from Scotland, was brought up a Presbyterian in the tradition of John Knox, and the Presbyterian Puritans at least believed that here was the man who was going to purify the Church of England. They arranged the Hampton Court Conference in 1604, in which they demanded the abolition of bishops, and James simply said, no bishop, no king, and that these people would have to conform or he would herald them out of the land. Well, about the only thing that came out of the Hampton Court Conference was that King James agreed that the Bible ought to have a new translation, and appointed a commission to proceed with that translation. And the translation that resulted, as you know, then was the King James Version, published in 1611. During the early years of James, then, some of the Puritans, particularly your Congregational Puritans, fled to Holland. Among these, John Robinson and the Scrooby congregation is the most important. They were the ones who then in 1620 emigrated from Holland and went to New England, leaving their pastor John Robinson behind, but settling there at Plymouth then in Massachusetts. But among those who fled from England were also the beginners of the Baptist denominations as we know them today. John Smith, S-M-Y-T-H. And you could hardly think of a more nondescript name than the name of John Smith as the name of the founder of a denomination. But John Smith, perhaps around the year 1607, became the sea baptizer. He baptized himself with that act founded the, well, at least historically, I think, began the Baptist denomination. So you see, out of Puritanism so far, we have the Presbyterian stream. Of course, Presbyterianism goes over to Scotland and back to Calvin already, but at least we have Presbyterian Puritanism, Congregationalism, and the Baptists. And these denominations take their rise, let's say roughly around the year 1600, out of this Puritan movement. Troubles that Charles I had with his government and the demands that he made, I'm not going to go into that. Let's simply note that the Puritans in England were in political power between 1640, roughly between 1649 and 1660. During this period, we note that the so-called left wing of Puritanism, the Levellers and the Fifth Monarchy men and so on and so forth, are evident. It's during this time that you have your Quakers rising out of the Puritan movement. John Fox was a Puritan before he was a Quaker. And the Quaker movement and some of these quasi-spiritualistic movements are evident in England during the 1640s and 1650s. In 1660, then, Anglicanism is restored to England, and in 1689, you have the Act of Toleration, 1689, the Act of Toleration, by which these nonconformists, then, the Congregationalists, the Presbyterians, the Quakers, the Baptists, those denominations particularly might exist with legal right in England. In the meantime, some of those who Puritans who were fearful of persecution or who believed that they had an opportunity to establish a new Zion fled over to this country. And especially in the period between 1629 and 1640, you have the Great Migration. The Great Migration which settles the territory around Boston and makes Boston not merely the hub of the universe, but also the center in which Puritanism is concentrated in this country. The political history there we're not going to be concerned with. Let's note, however, that out of this migration, you have the establishment of what becomes a another branch of Puritanism in Rhode Island, an intense separatistic independent strain under Roger Williams. Roger Williams, in his bloody tenets of persecution, insisting on the separation of church and state, and insisting on it, on the futility of persecution. Let me read only one of his tenets here. A tenet all red and bloody with those most barbarous and tiger-like massacres of so many thousands and 10,000s formerly in France and other parts and so lately and so horribly in Ireland, of which have ever causes be assigned, this chiefly will be found the truth. While this continues, to wit violence against conscience, this bloody issue sooner or later must break forth again, except God wonderfully stop it in Ireland and other places too. Well, that's just one example to show how Roger Williams first agitated for the sake of the church, a separation of church and state and the granting of religious liberty. But let's go over to spend a little time on Puritan theology, the covenant theology, and the worship of the Puritans. Perhaps I can stop at this point if there should be any questions that any of you have. There is the establishment of Plymouth in 1620, and these are the so-called pilgrims. And then the Massachusetts Bay Colony, or the few that came over in 1628 already, but primarily the migration between 1629 and 1640, which really constitutes the so-called Puritan oligarchy and so on. It's primarily this second group that I'm referring to. They were the really the influential ones. Actually, the Plymouth group had very little meaning in subsequent American history. Yes, they were definitely separatistic independent. Well, Roger Williams was banished in 1636, so it has its beginnings in this period. It influenced the Dutch Calvinists, and you have among the Dutch Calvinists, particularly Cochaeus, who picked up much of the Puritan theology. I am positive that Puritanism influenced Pietism, and you have the precisionists in Holland, which are the Dutch Puritans, if you want to use that term, and then the Pietists among the Lutherans, both of whom can find their roots in the Puritan movement. Your question. It's among the laymen, I would say. There is a good share of pastors among them, and the pastors stand out as the leaders. But it is a middle class movement.
Peter repeated or come up with American.
Well, maybe I can repeat them.
If the pilgrims at Plymouth were Puritans as were the those at Massachusetts Bay, were they together at all? Did they get together doctrinally or in practice at all? It seems that they were separate from history.
They were congregationalists, and under the congregationalist theory, each congregation determined for itself its doctrine. But there were fraternal relations between the Plymouth colony and the colonies in, around the Massachusetts Bay area. Yes. If you're a dyed-in-the-wool Baptist and insist that the Baptist is the only true church, then you'll find the origins of the Baptist church in John the Baptist, the forerunner of Christ. You see, but the sober historian will regard John Smith as the founder of the Baptist church. Let's go on then to say a few things yet before too late about Puritan theology. I spoke before of Puritanism as English Calvinism. In Calvinism, you have the emphasis on the sovereignty of God, an emphasis on the doctrine of election, and on what we would call sanctification. The Puritan theology is more often, especially since the researches of Perry Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R. Perry Miller researches have shown the large emphasis on the covenant theology among the Puritans. This covenant theology, at least so Perry Miller interprets it, is an attempt to soften the harshness of Calvinism. Calvinism stressing the sovereignty of God. In Puritanism, it's softened to the extent that God is put on a more understandable basis, that he is not simply the pure, the transcendent God. Then the decree of reprobation in Calvinism is softened by this, that God makes his covenant, and in this covenant gives the assurance of salvation. And the third point, the piety, the morality, sanctification of the Puritans, is emphasized by this, that if you make a covenant, there are two parties to the agreement, and in this covenant, you are a party, you agree